In 2011, filmmaker Alexander Payne options a book by Hawaiian novelist Kauai Hart Hemmings. Payne immediately reaches out to another writing duo of Nat Faxon and Jim Rash. And the three of those folks create the movie Descendants. The George Clooney movie Descendants is the one that I'm referencing. And if you saw the movie or you read the book, if you remember, the story orients itself around a character named Matt King. And there are two separate storylines that run at the same time throughout the entirety of the movie, and from time to time they intertwine and intercept one another. But it is a wonderful movie. The first storyline is about Matt King's immediate family, about Matt, his wife, and their two daughters. When the movie opens, we get the sense that Matt's wife has been in a horrible boating accident in Hawaii, and we learn very quickly that she's been hospitalized for several weeks, and her condition continues to deteriorate. As the movie develops, the doctors bring Matt into the conference room at the hospital and make him aware that his wife, in fact, will not survive the injuries that she has sustained. And it becomes his job to reach out to his two daughters, one of whom is away at school because she's been a rowdy adolescent and hard to control. So she's on another Hawaiian island in a school, the other of whom is at home. But Matt expresses his insecurity about being a dad, especially as the solo parent. He's like, no, no, I'm the second parent, not the first parent. It's a complicated story. It's also Matt's job to reach out to his the community of friends in which Matt and his wife have raised their family, to let them know that it is time for them to go to the hospital and say goodbye to their dear one. That's the first storyline that runs through the movie. And if you remember the second storyline that runs through the movie, it's that Matt comes from an old Hawaiian family. And that family, Matt's family, are in fact like Hawaiian land barons, going all the way back to like the British royal line in Hawaii. And Matt is the sole trustee of a family trust that is about to expire, that's related to a huge piece of property, a beautiful and very valuable piece of property on the north shore of the island of Kauai. And so Matt has this impending decision to make that it affects his entire family, that is probably somewhere around 30 to 50 people. We come to learn very quickly that Matt is a jackalope in the King family, that he is one of the only members of the family who has been responsible with the financial resource that he has inherited, and that he has not spent a dime of his inherited wealth. In fact, that he has raised his family on the income that he has made from his law practice. Matt's family members have all squandered their inheritance and are very excited about the impending transaction that will make the entire family fabulously wealthy again. It's a wild tale that Payne and Faxon and Rash put up on the screen, and it's brilliantly done. it gives us this sense of the dynamics that exist in families, especially large families. And the movie is ultimately nominated for six Oscars, and Payne and Faxon and Rash take home one for Best Adapted Screenplay. I think they win the prize, and I think the popularity of the movie exists because, as you see, both Matt King's immediate family's interaction and Matt King's extended family's interaction, you have this experience of family life being one of the most cringiest things that humanity can experience or endure. I mean to tell you that the King family is the icon of dysfunctional families, but I also mean to tell you from my own familial experience, an experience also with my wife's family for the last 29 years, and from my 25 years of experience as a pastor, pastoring people through the ups and downs of life, I have yet to encounter a family that we would brand as functional. I would even give you a straight-up piece of advice right now this morning. Follow it or don't. But here's my advice. If you are the one in the family who is working hard at turning your family from dysfunctional to functional, I encourage you to lay your burden down. If you were successful, in my experience, you would be the first one. Now, I mention this reality about our family relationships because in the lectionary during the Easter season, these readings that we have from the biblical text from Easter Sunday morning through today, there are tons of references, both direct and indirect, to family. The image of the early church, Jesus and his disciples, and as the church begins to grow and expand, is an image of family. It's not just a community of people working their way to connect one to another, but there is a measure of trust and intimacy that is narrated within the biblical text that we know there's even more than that. And John's gospel and then the reading that we heard from 1 John, there is a particular emphasis. John frequently makes the reference of God as Father and Jesus as Son. And we get this idea of, like, because Jesus is in the Father and the Father in him and Jesus is connected to us, that we are all a part of this family of faith. Now, I should stop here and pause here and say, if we were writing this stuff today, these stories today, we would use father and mother, right? Because it's family that we're talking about. But the paternal references are not meant to be patriarchal, a part of the patriarchy. They're meant to narrate the close connection that we have both to God and one another. We have these images of the sheep herd, the flock, and the flock being tended by the loving good shepherd. We have the image of us being connected as a vine, and that God is the tender of this vine, and make sure that the vine grows and is able to flourish in its place. There are so many parallels that are drawn to this idea that we are a family. And what we are meant to understand here as people of faith, and oftentimes I don't say like St. John's Church. I'll say like the St. John's family. Because the work that we have to do as a church, we sit under this mission, this sort of underground, unwritten mission at St. John's Episcopal Church is we cover this valley in love like snow covers it in the winter time. So we know that we're brought together under the banner of a particular mission. And by virtue of that, I would say we're not just a family, but we're a family business. We are in the business of spreading love and making a difference in the community of Jackson Hole and well beyond. And here's what I can tell you about family businesses. They are fraught with dysfunction, right? Just like families are, they're tricky. They're not perfect. And yet, we lean into this metaphor because we, as human beings, as creatures made in the image of God, who we know to be love, we were made for connection, one to another and to God. It's a beautiful formula. Now, if you have been around church for the last month or so, you have a sense that I have not been here. I've been gone. Some people are scratching their heads. I have taken this wonderful privilege this spring to spend time with my daughter Jade on the lacrosse field. I on the sidelines, she on the field itself. Because of the nature of my job, and all of us who have kids and have raised kids in Jackson Hole, once they get to a certain age, you have some sense that if your kids play sports in Jackson Hole, you are on the road. Every weekend, you're in some different place. And for the last four weekends, including Friday and Saturday, I've had this great privilege of being in Montana with my daughter Jade and all her teammates. And I can tell you, like, I have cried so many tears of joy behind the disguise of my sunglasses and my hat on the sidelines in Montana, savoring this experience with Jade. It's been a beautiful moment. Those of us who have kids who are athletes know of that feeling as you're there supporting your child and his or her teammates. And it's wonderful. On Friday evening, when we got to Bozeman and we got to the fields, we were sort of joking around with some of the girls, and the coaches rolled up. Dave knows these coaches. As these coaches rolled up, and we were just like chatting, just a little banter back and forth. And one of Jade's coaches, Maddie, said something like, and you should know, like, these coaches, they're working full-time jobs, at least one or two. And then every weekend, they're on the road to Montana or somewhere else. Every afternoon, they're at practice coaching these girls. And then when the girls need a little extra support, they're at Cowboy Coffee talking to these girls. They're so generous with their time and their spirit and their expertise. And I'm just not surprised that, like, in this conversation with Maddie, she was like, you know, I'm a little cooked. I just, like, you know, it's just been a long few weekends, and I got to come up with inspiration, but I'm just a little burned. And then she looked at me, and she's like, wait, you do inspiration? you could give us some inspiration sometimes. I was like, sure, Maddie. Anything Maddie says, Maddie's going to get from me. Like, she is a marvelous coach. And I was like, yeah, like, maybe next weekend or something when the home tournament, if you want me to, like, shoot me a text or send me an email. And then the girls came together under Maddie's leadership and dominated Bozeman. Just dominated them. It was so great to see. Loved it. Loved every minute of it. So we have on Saturday morning a really early game. And we have a really early game because last night was prom night. And so a lot of these varsity girls want to be home to go to their senior prom. Totally understandable, right? So at 8 o'clock in the morning in Bozeman, Montana, we are playing like our unofficial arch rivals, Billings Rimrock. So Jade and I wake up in the hotel room at 5:50. We pack the bags. We get out of the hotel. We go to Starbucks. We get her a little food for her stomach and some kind of special drink, a pink drink. Do you know this drink? It looks terrible. But it's like part of Jade's like lacrosse superstition thing. Like baseball players don't shave. Jade needs a pink drink. And she needs to give her friend Selah some of those like Haribo frogs. Don't ask me. I don't understand. So anyway, we get her something to eat, and we get her the pink drink, we go to the fields, it's about 6:35 or so, and one of the things that I love about Maddie is she's like, if you're early, you're on time, if you're on time, you're late. And so at about 6:40, Jade's like, okay, Dad, I'm going to the field now. I was like, okay, cool, you know, get after it, honey, be aggressive, let them blow the whistle, get a yellow card. I say get a yellow card because Jade is not that of an aggressive lacrosse player, and I think if she's thinking about getting a yellow card, she'll be aggressive enough to get the whistle blown. So she goes out onto the field. She's maybe 200, 250 yards away. I see him all out there, and I'm listening to music in the truck. It's cold. The sun's shining. It's a beautiful day in Paradise Valley, Montana. It's just like everything has come together. And then, like, the music cuts off, and my phone rings. And I look at the screen in my truck, and it says Jade Bartz. And I'm like, okay, I know how this goes. Like, mouth guard, cleats, stick, something's in the truck, and I need to go bring it. So I answer the phone. I'm like, hey, honey, what's up? What do you need? And she's like, okay, hey, I'm over here on the sidelines, and Maddie is saying something about inspiration. And I was like, what's she saying? She's like, that you're doing the inspiration this morning? And I was like, this morning? And she's like, yeah, Maddie's like right now, she's saying like, yeah, you're doing the inspiration. And I was like, okay. And then I immediately flash back to this experience that I had when I was headed towards seminary. This mentoring priest, a guy named Dub Brooks, told me, he's like, Jimmy, if you're going to be a priest, you have to be prepared to do three things at any time. I was like, what's that, Dub? His name is Dub Brooks. What's that, Dub? And he said, at any time anyone asks you, you have to be prepared to preach, pray, or die. And I was like, okay. So Dub comes to mind. And over the course of the next 250 yards, I begin to craft a non-faith-based sermon. And here's what I told these girls. And all of you who have kids and have watched your kids play sports growing up, you know this experience that I'm talking about. I told these girls, I said, I'm not going to talk about your experience. I'm going to talk about mine. Parents have a unique experience watching their kids grow up playing sports. And it begins quite early for most of us, 4, 5 years old, on the soccer field, on the hockey ice, on the lacrosse field, where we watch. We watch a herd of kids move around the field. And ultimately, that herd gets somewhere close to a goal, and some lucky kid puts his or her foot on the ball, and it happens to go in the goal, and the whistle blows, and everyone comes to midfield, and you start the herd all over again. And that lasts from like 4 years old to 5 years old to 6 years old to 7 years old to 8 years old, and then maybe at like 9 or 10, there's this communal conversion moment. And it happens with one kid. And I don't exactly know why it happens. It might happen because that kid is listening to the coaches. It may happen because that kid is listening to coach, mom, or dad, or grandma, or grandpa on the way home from the game. It may happen because that kid is just one of those human beings who is hardwired with some athletic instinct that's just more than the majority. But some point, somewhere around that age, you see a kid pass the ball. And when that one kid passes the ball, it changes the game for everyone. All of a sudden, this herd, which is representative of like radical independence, like I am going to take this ball and get it to the goal and get all of the glory. It takes this group from radical independence to a place of interdependence. And it is a beautiful thing to see. It's a gorgeous image of how humanity was made to connect, to cooperate, to collaborate. We were made for it. And as a parent on a sideline, you can watch it happen before your very eyes, and you get this message of like, that's right. That's right. Better together. We're better together. We're better together in our families. We're better together in our family businesses, even with the dysfunction. We're better together in our church families. We were made to connect one to another. Now, this is a different Sunday morning. I wouldn't say in particular that it's special, other than this is a special moment to be in the room together like it is almost every Sunday. But we're here on a Sunday morning where we are putting forth, publicizing, making known the opportunities that this church affords for connection, to connect one to another, to occupy a role, to engage a task, to join a group. There are opportunities all around that room in Hanson Hall. And in order to get you into that room to see those opportunities, there are also fajitas. And I love fajitas. I love eating fajitas with family. And you are family, church. Go in and see if there is a task or a role or a group. Or if you don't want to, that's cool too. But when you leave this place this morning, remember that we are wired for connection, that we are built for collaboration, and that we are always better together. Amen.